Jesuits who also, the Jesuits were, of course, some of the most progressive in education, and they had founded universities in what's today Portugal and Spain, and they, especially at Coimbra in present-day Portugal, they created quite an esteemed faculty, which produced, among other things, a whole series of commentaries on the works of Aristotle. And that started in the 1580s and went into the, I think, into the 1620s. But obviously those works, plus other works, works, reports from Jesuits who had gone to the New World, for example, from those who had gone to China and the like, certainly, if not actual texts, stories of those came to the Jesuit university, Jesuit colleges and universities very quickly. And that probably means that Descartes, being allowed to read fairly widely in the library, was able to consult, to have as good an education, at least in terms of the reading that he did, as anyone in his day, better than many, in fact. And one of the wonderful things about those commentaries on Aristotle is that they tended to be, and here I do need, so I don't want to get blue. If you have the book looking something like this, well, that's too curved. But here you would have a Greek text. Here on the facing page, you would have a Latin text. And then going up and down the page, you would have, usually in four columns per page, you would have commentary on it. And the commentary was also heavily footnoted. Although, you know, one has to understand, it's not possible to explain at length in a commentary like that the interpretation of any one or several thinkers about and other commentators about Aristotle, but basically almost all the ancient and medieval, not just Latin but also those who wrote originally in Arabic or Persian, even rough contemporaries were cited here. So it was a kind of introduction to the state of the response to Aristotle. And so a good deal of, for instance, in the commentary on some of the physical treatises of Aristotle, there was a good deal of at least generic description of scientific work and scientific philosophizing that was done. Though science is not exactly the most appropriate word to use here, since, one thing, if we think about in English, scientist is a word that doesn't enter until the 1830s, though science has been around for a while. Natural philosophy is what most people would have called in English, or even in Latin and French, the appropriate name is getting made, to describe the kind of research and study of nature and the foundations of that study. As I said, when he left school, he went on to get a law degree. It was expected, his family expected him then to come back to the Poitou and to take perhaps a seat in the parliament there. But he had no interest in it. And he essentially managed to negotiate a settlement, that is, his inheritance. He got at a discounted rate. It was enough to assure that he could live relatively comfortably and independently for the rest of his life. And I'd like to point out, although sometimes, because he spent the majority of his years after 1628 in Holland. And some people make a big deal about the fact, well, maybe that's a sign. He went to a Protestant country. Perhaps he wasn't such a It was a free-thinking place. Perhaps he wasn't such an orthodox Catholic, and it was for safety. One can't forget the question of where it's cheapest to live. He also said he very much enjoyed the kind of privacy he had there. He said it's wonderful to be able to walk on the street and to hear all these sounds and to be with your own thoughts, because you weren't able to understand enough to be constantly distracted. He's not really a misanthrope, but he certainly enjoyed being alone with his thoughts. I'm not going to say a lot more about it. I will say some things about the general interpretation, methods of interpretation of Descartes a little bit later. I think the questioning of his religiosity is bogus. UD is one of the places where people like to question his religiosity. I reassert, I think it's bogus. I can't go into detail about that. But one thing, the accusation often depends on thinking that an Orthodox Catholic in the 1620s and 30s has to think like we do today. And that's what you have to do, is look at what the range of orthodoxy was in the places in question. And my wife in particular is even better suited than I, since she's a historian of France of the early modern period. She also does history of medicine. She finds even less credible than I do the arguments that are predicated on the notion that he's unorthodox. So take my word for it or not. But if you want to know more about Descartes' life and some about his thought, I have two books. This is show and tell tonight. Two books to recommend. This is shorter, and it's got more about his life than his works. It's not really the best place to go if you want to know about his philosophy in detail. But if you want to know more details about what he was doing, where and when, whom he was talking to and meeting, this book, Descartes, His Life and Thought. The author is Geneviève Rodis-Levis. Let me write that down. I think she may still, in fact, be alive. She is always a very solid scholar and dependable. She doesn't have many axes to grind. She's a good place to begin on any topic that she writes about. The other book is Descartes, An Intellectual Biography by Stephen Gaukroger. I'll just say, I should start with the name again. Stephen Gaukroger is how you pronounce it. I have it from his mouth, but that's how you pronounce it. He even gave me a little etymology of it, which I promptly forgot. A Descartes, An Intellectual Biography, and it's an Oxford University Press book. It came out, I guess, about 10 years ago, a little more than that, 95. Gaukroger also, now this work is better than Rodis-Levis on, well, the intellectual biography, as the subtitle has it, the intellectual matters. And Gaukroger, being a particular a votary of history and philosophy of science, is a reliable guide to Descartes' scientific and mathematical writings. If I remember, I will add another one to that. Maybe it's here. It's William, is it Shea or O'Shea? I've forgotten. William Shea, S-H-E-A, S-H-E-A, William, The Magic of Numbers and Motion. Subtitle, Scientific Career of René Descartes, The Magic of Numbers and Motion. William Shea, S-H-E-A. And that is strictly, as much philosophy is introduced as is necessary to make clear some of the implications of his scientific and his mathematical writings. So that's bibliography, show and tell. I took you to the point where he was going to start out a legal and political career, but then got a buyout. What he did then is he decided to see the world. And so he says some of this in the account he gives. Now, one thing you have to realize is Descartes, people have for almost four centuries been tracking down what Descartes said and trying to make sure when he talks about doing something at a particular time that it's accurate. And he is uncommonly accurate. So if he says 3 years earlier he had done something, then the only question is whether we know exactly when that passage was being written and whether he means from the moment he wrote it or when it was printed, okay, or just before it was printed. And we're not always sure about that, so that creates a kind of window for it. But one thing he decided to do was to see the world. You can see he went through his, what the Germans would call the Lehrjahre, the years of instruction, and he went on to the years of wandering, the Wanderjahre, as an apprentice might do in the Middle Ages. First learn with a master and then travel from master to master. And although Descartes obviously is not one to easily accept another as a master, because after all, he says, to start out with in his autobiographical account, that pretty much everyone is equally endowed with good sense, or common sense, basic reason, horse sense, however we're going to render it. Although he promptly admits that people have different subordinate capacities, you know, better memory or worse, a better imagination or worse, prompter ability to catch on to something or not, quicker wit and the like. He decided to travel, and now there are, again, there are stories about this, but it looks like early on he was wondering, he had heard that lots of people were claiming at the time to have a secret knowledge of the cosmos. Okay, he seems from early on to have had a certain skeptical turn of mind about such things, but he also seems to have used his travels in part to look into some of these things. That had a certain repercussions later on in his life. For instance, when after a fairly long period of 6 years of being essentially out of France, when he did these wandering years, he came to Paris, and it was just at that time that posters mysteriously appeared throughout the city announcing the arrival of the Brotherhood of the Rosy Cross, the Rosicrucians. And of course, the Rosicrucians are one of those largely mythical secret societies that were considered to be dangerous to monarchy, Catholicism, or Protestantism, depending on where you were, and to good social order, and so there was actually an attempt by the authorities to find them out, and apparently Descartes was questioned since he had arrived at about that time. Now the thing is that he was aware of the Rosicrucians. He probably encountered some who considered themselves such in Germany. Although what he was looking for was what could be translated into basically what we could call scientific knowledge and mathematical knowledge. He was especially eager to find those. Quite early in his wanderings, probably at some point in the second year, when he passed through Holland, he ran into a fellow named Isaac Beckman, more or less. Probably these days people would use a K rather than a I-S-A-A-K, and the E-C-K-M-A-N, although you're as likely to see that as a C for Isaac. Who was about 10 years his senior. Beckman wasn't all that influential in his day, but he kept a detailed journal, and anytime anyone of
with claims to wisdom, especially if they had mathematical knowledge or knowledge of nature. He would glom onto them and pump them for everything he could. Actually, they struck up a bit of a friendship. And in his journal for this time, and we're talking about late 1618 and early 1619, apparently that's where the military that Descartes had joined was bivouacking for the winter. Bacon said that he had never encountered anyone who did and was interested in problems of nature in the same way that he was. And he used the term, he was a physico-mathematician. Would it be far wrong to say mathematical physicist? There are records of their conversations, some records of their conversations about various mathematical and scientific topics. It was also the occasion for Descartes' first mature work. It's a very early work, but it's also mature. It's called Compendium of Music. By compendium, it doesn't mean anything lengthy, but rather something short, abbreviated, but containing all the essentials. It runs about 50 pages in Latin, and what it is a kind of the basic theory of music, explained in terms largely of mathematical proportions. Not terribly innovative. I have seen accounts by professional experts in music theory who have said that there's nothing really original in it, though it's a very effective and concise account. And I've seen others claim that no, indeed, there is some innovation in it. But one thing it shows already, and this is something that Beckmann noted in his journals, is that Descartes was really expert at using figures in order to express mathematical and proportional relationships to one another. When we read in the second of the six discourses, the discourse on the method, we see him presenting certain rules of method, and those are taken by everyone to be most important, and I think it's actually the paragraphs that immediately follow that are even more important, because it's a kind of summary of the kind of mathematics he undertook. It's a very visual mathematics in its way. Everything, if you have a problem to solve, well, you do follow the rules of method that he pronounces there, which is, first of all, don't accept anything as true unless you clearly and distinctly see it to be so. If that sounds like it's great, if you can get it, but what really is clear and distinct in human things? But then you remember that, of course, everyone says that Descartes introduces mathematics as the model of knowing. There's plenty that you can see in, especially in geometry. You can literally see certain things clearly and distinctly. Although the issue usually is how you set up a visual display. You can't just throw any figures down on a sheet of paper and use them to the best mathematical effect. I'm not very good at it because I'll draw a triangle and it'll look like that, and no triangle looks like that. It's just that I'm too fast, but when I try more slowly, it isn't all that much better. Now, for most reasoning, it doesn't really matter. But often enough, what you have to do is you have to draw, you have to conceptualize, you have to redraw, you have to reconceptualize. For instance, if you say, okay, what I'm going to do is I'll take an isosceles triangle. You know, it has two sides equal, and there's a nice straight side for you. I'm marking those as equal. Now, of course, I can tell you just take an isosceles triangle, and now I draw from the side that is not an equal side, bisect that side that is divided exactly in half, and then draw from the opposite vertex a line to that point. And some of you probably are doing that fine in your imaginations, and others of you said, huh? And so I say, okay, these are the equal sides. This is not, you bisect this, and then you just draw this. Okay.
And of course you all see clearly and distinctly, don't you, that those are congruent triangles? What's a congruent triangle? Well, these are two triangles have congruence. Although every triangle is congruent to itself. Okay, yes. Just as A equals A. You have to have, well, there are various ways of showing it. For instance, you have two sides equal and the angle between them equal, if that's true, or if you have the three sides equal to one another. In this one, the three sides of those, now there are three triangles there, of course, right? The large one and then the two smaller ones that it's been divided into. I want you just to focus on the two smaller ones. Can you see that they're congruent, that they have three sides, they have corresponding equal sides? Because this side in this triangle on the left is equal to this side in this one, and because this was a bisecting point, this is equal to that, and of course they share this line segment. Okay, so there. Now you see it clearly and distinctly, right? And what Descartes means by clear and distinct should be, clear and distinct now, in a certain kind of way. Now, if any of you would have the time, and if I had assigned to you what I do often in teaching Descartes, usually if I have more time than just a couple of hours, I'll have people read a work which is, many people say is the kind of antecedent of the Discourse on the Method. Discourse on the Method is actually a preface. It's a preface to three scientific essays published in 1637. The discourse is written basically in 1637 or late 1636. Okay, the essays are written and finished in the preceding 3 years, 1634 to 37. Though they're actually done by the end of 1636. Okay, and what they are is there's a work of optics. It's called dioptrics because it's about lenses and. That's what the specialty of optics concerned with lenses was called in Latin, the optrice, dioptrics. And, of course, Italianate Latin is the optrice. Then there was a work called the meteorology. And here the meteors meant atmospheric phenomena that occur in the atmosphere. And so it was a kind of physics of atmospheric phenomena. And then the last essay was what's called the Geometry. And it is one of the founding works of what we know as analytic geometry. And Descartes is considered, along with his contemporary, but certainly not someone he cooperated with, Pierre Fermat, F-E-R-M-A-T, as the originator, the inventor of analytic geometry. What does analytic geometry do? You learn how to graph equations, right? You discover that if you have, you find equations for curves for equations, you learn how to graph them. So it coordinates algebra and geometry. It's not accidental that he called it the geometry, though, because he considers geometry still to be the queen of sciences, as it had been, and certainly of the mathematical sciences, as had been the case since antiquity. What algebra was good for was tracking geometrical relationships. In the first instance, algebra was nothing more than an extension of what we do when we label, for instance, we say A, B, C, and this will be called point D. It's a label. So you would, for instance, say the length of line AB will be represented by K. And then if you want to have a line that's twice as long, you take a length K, take a line, of course, a long and extendable line, you take a point on it, you mark off length K, then you mark off another length K, right? So they've been doing that since antiquity, certainly since Euclid's Elements around 300 BC. And Descartes does that, but he does a lot more. And what's really unique about it is he's and this is in the work that he does already
that I said is the antecedent of this discourse. So work that he may have begun as early as 1619, so when he was traveling, when just after he met Beckmann. Maybe he didn't begin it till the mid-1620s. Maybe he didn't do it till about 1628, but he seems to have abandoned it by 1629. That seems to be clear. And you wouldn't believe the controversies over how to date it, but there are controversies. They aren't terribly important. It does seem that he already had, around 1619, the beginnings of the kind of mathematics that he was systematizing in this work, which was called rules, or reguli, because he wrote it in Latin, reguli, rules for the direction of the mind. Well, that's a terrible translation. For the direction, and the noun is ingenii, the ingenious power, the power of invention, the native wit that allows us to see in things in a kind of original and novel way. And some more recent translations play with, you know, exact native intelligence is one way of putting it. That's the inborn character of the etymology of that word. Inborn, in a sense, is what it's is what it's connected to, at least. And so that's the point of native intelligence. But it really is a kind of discovery. And you may have noticed that when he gives his evaluation of his education early on in the discourse, he doesn't actually have that much favorable to say about logic and the highest forms of mathematics. They had geometry and algebra. About logic, basically, and throughout his life, he said, logic is good once you already know the truth. I mean, it's a way of presenting the truth. It's lousy if you want to discover new truths. Search for the middle term, say the Aristotelians. That is, you're going to say, all A's are B's, all B's are C's, therefore all A's are C's. B is the middle term. If you want to connect the term A and the term C, you have to find some truth relating A and B and B and C. That's finding the middle term. Okay, great. Search for the middle term. It didn't give anything more directional, directive than that. And that, very early on, is something that Descartes thought was crucially important. If there's a method for pursuing knowledge, it ought to be productive. It ought to be something that gives you an idea of what to do next, and not just leave you there gaping at a problem. You know, you've all tried to solve word problems, right? And what the first thing you do, if you don't have a method, is stare at it, hoping that the answer pops into your mind. Whereas Descartes says, look, first of all, don't accept anything that's not clear to state. That's true. Always remember that. But that you can say, is the overriding, that is the ultimate, that's the prime directive of Descartes, of his philosophy. But to solve a problem, immediately start breaking down the problem. Divide. That's the second rule. Divide it into as many parts as you can. And of course, a lot of us today, especially, you know, after hundreds of years of the scientific revolution, sometimes we say, well, science hasn't been actually unalloyed good, and therefore this analytic method which breaks everything down, you have to kill to analyze and the like. And there's a lot of truth to that. But Descartes would say, look, you're given a problem about, and I'll use a problem that is the kind you would find as a word problem. Maybe you've heard this before from my mom. So you have one of those famous problems. You've got a truck that sets out from Dallas at noon. And also at noon, there's a truck that sets out from Fort Worth. The Fort Worth truck is headed to Dallas, and the Dallas truck is headed towards Fort Worth. They're on opposite ends of I-30. And the truck headed out from Dallas is going at a certain speed, let's say 40 miles per hour on average. And we'll assume there's this completely unreal problem, there's no traffic problem, so it's able to maintain that speed the whole time. That's, you know, from the top of the ramp when it enters to the moment it leaves. And then the other truck is coming in the opposite direction at 20 miles per hour from Fort Worth. And I ask you,
Well, where do their paths essentially cross on I-30? And some of you may actually be able, given that problem, or written down, to stare at it and immediately see what it must be. In fact, I'll say two-thirds of the way from Dallas to Fort Worth. One vehicle is going twice as fast as the other. So it's going to cover two units of space for every one that the other. And if you have it divided into three equal parts, the Dallas truck will have gone two of those two-thirds of the distance in one direction, and the Fort Worth truck one-third in the other. Ah, but do you really know? It sounds plausible, doesn't it? But is it really true? What you have to do is say, you break it down into parts. And I didn't really break it. I've broken it down a little bit into components of the problem. What really counts in it? In fact, it doesn't matter that we know it's 40 and 20. This was the sort of thing that was wonderfully illuminating to Descartes. He said, why give a specific value if just we say one is going twice as fast as the other? It doesn't matter whether it's going 100 miles per hour or 1 mile per hour. If the ratio of the velocities is 2 to 1, they will always cross at the point that's two-thirds. That's a kind of generalization of a method of solving a problem. You can solve the problem with specific values, but you can generalize the solution and make it more of a general algorithm. And then you find further ways of generalizing it. But Descartes always said that, look, you have to divide it into parts, and one thing you also need to do is you then need to focus on the relationships between those parts that you isolate. There's not a virtue of breaking down things if you don't start relating the parts to one another to see how they're really related. That means you keep going back to the statement of the problem, and you keep asking yourself about what exactly are the relations that exist for moving things, for example. And so you say, okay, what are the things I know? Well, I know that the trucks start at, there's this road they're on, a single road. We know that they're going to pass one another at some point. If we ask how we know that, we'd have to talk about the continuity of substance and that really metaphysical questions. But Descartes doesn't like to get into actually more sophistication and subtlety than is necessary. Indeed, lots of commentators on his method say that it's surprising how little you really have to know in order to use his method. In a sense, he says, think into the problem only as far as is necessary to solve the problem. Why? It's not because he's an obscurantist who doesn't want to know things. He actually wants to know everything that he can. But to solve a problem, the point is not to make things difficult for yourself. And in fact, he thinks the method ought to be universalizable in some way so that you can use it in any kind of situation. Not that every problem allows itself for a definite solution the way the two trucks does. In this work, The Reguli, he only finished slightly less than half of what he projected. And we know he indicated exactly what he planned to do. 36 parts. Okay, he did have 12, which are almost complete. Then he has another 9 headings, and 6 of those look pretty complete, although a couple are sketchy. And then he said there was going to be a third, 3 more in that section, and then another 12 in another section. And he was going to consider, first of all, general theory, then of how to solve perfect problems, that is, problems which had everything you needed to solve the problem, and then imperfect problems. That is, problems where you didn't really have enough to solve it. And you say, well, what good is that? Well, actually, it's nice to know when you can't solve a problem, why you can't solve it. If you can reach the point where you can say, if I had such and such information in addition, I would be able to solve it, then that's actually a kind of positive acquisition. There might also be certain kinds of problems you discover that aren't solvable, but I really can't touch on that. So what he taught in the Reguli is that first thing you have to do is break problems down into parts, then establish relations. You need to represent the relations, and you need to represent them in a way that they're easily visual. As he has, I'll be able to hold this up to you. This is he shows. I mean, he has, from this work we have. He shows, for instance, it's hard to see, he's got four vertical lines and a kind of square that's divided into 16 smaller squares, and then a larger 16 square circle which has diagonals in each one. And what he's saying there is that, well, if we're for example trying to understand the difference that a color is made, we need some way of portraying the difference. Initially, we don't necessarily know what the real physical difference is between colors. But one thing we know is that color must somehow make an impression on the eye. And so if we want to represent different colors, it would be useful, for instance, to say, well, red will correspond to this pattern, and blue to this, and green to this, perhaps. Now you say, well, what good is that? He says, well, you have to try some of these things, because it might turn out that the representation itself is useful, just holding the distinctions in mind. That's why you put different letters down here to keep in mind the distinctions. But the letters don't really mean anything unless you correlate it with the figure. These diagrams don't mean anything unless you correlate it with the phenomenon. You may discover, this doesn't work, but you may discover, for instance, that perhaps colors are somehow physiologically produced by differential pressure on the retina. Just imagine that as a scientific possibility. And that there's one pattern for blue and another for red, and if you superimpose them, it creates a new pattern which corresponds to an intermediate color between them. Green, perhaps. So what he was looking for, he said, and the figures, the advantage of figures, not just lines, not just ordinary two-dimensional figures, but the full variety of figures in two and three dimensions would be sufficient to represent all the differences in the phenomena that we encounter in the world and in the problems we have to solve. But in the reguli, he began realizing that, well, why not represent all differences in terms of, first of all, longer and shorter lines? And the point is not to say that color, for example, it is a line of a certain length, but you're representing it, and perhaps you're representing some common property. He talked about finding simple natures and dimensions of phenomena that you could then, more or less, once you took that as fixed, you could quantify. Now, one thing I'm going to mention that's very, very easy to do, if you consider a certain amount of light, and you say, well, there are lights that are brighter and lights that are darker, why can't we have units of measurement to measure and establish those by numerals, but perhaps to represent them also as line segments? So one that's twice as bright or three times as bright will be twice or three times as long. Or maybe we'll use an area to represent that. Why not three dimensions? Actually, one of the genius of the rules is it's the first point in his career where he says to himself, you know, everyone before me this is a problem of ancient mathematics. You know that multiplication is literally taken, not as an algebraic or arithmetic operation, but as a geometric operation. If you multiply one number by another, what they did typically is they took one line segment of that was A long, if you want to multiply A times B. They took one line segment A long, the other one B, they created a rectangle. And the area of that is the representation of the product. What's inconvenient about that is A and B are linear and A times B is in two dimensions. If you want to multiply three numbers, you have to construct a three-dimensional figure. And if you wanted to multiply four figures, you couldn't do it. Although actually they began developing theories of proportion. Theories of proportion allow you to say, well, this four-dimensional thing that we can't construct would be, with respect to this three-dimensional one that we can, the same as some other four-dimensional would be to another three-dimensional, which may be a solution to the problem we want. Or you use the three-dimensional ones to point to a counterfactual possibility. But the ancient mathematicians hated this idea of going beyond three dimensions. What Descartes was looking for, he wasn't the first to do it, but he really was the first to come up with a method that always worked, is that you could reduce two dimensions to one. Or you could raise one to two, but you never needed to go to a third dimension. if you wanted to multiply, you could do this. But then he gave you a technique that you could convert that multiplication, which is an area, into a line. So you could alternatively represent it as a line segment or as an area, whichever was more convenient for the solution of the problem. And that was one of the early mathematics, the problem-solving mathematics of Descartes. He wasn't committed to the notion that there was one unique way of representing a problem. Again, his very Catholic small c attitude towards solving problems: do only as much as you need to. Do what works. If two dimensions works better than one, do it. Then, by the time you get to the mid-1630s, he develops a far more powerful mathematics, which is basically analytic geometry. But it's still based on the notion, first of all, taking imageable figures, now considering them not simply as given, but as dynamically constructed. Basically, a line segment is produced by a moving point. Even more interesting, a circle or an oval or a portion of a hyperbola or a parabola is produced by a moving point. And you can specify that the motion of that point by taking any two lines that are not parallel to one another and identifying every point in the plane as a distance from those two lines. We take a specialized form of that for analytic geometry. We call it Cartesian coordinates, but the funny thing is it was Fermat, the co-inventor, who actually said, always start a two-dimensional problem by creating an x-axis and a y-axis perpendicular to one another. Descartes said, any two lines you like as long as they're not parallel. You know, again, that very Catholic attitude, use whatever works. Although in the long run, it's turned out the standardized, or as we call it in mathematics, the normal form, always use the normal form and convert everything to the normal form. It's turned out to be more practical. But Descartes would have been perfectly happy with that, too. But what he discovered is he could, therefore, start talking about the movements of points, in effect, subject to different forces simultaneously. And that's why it's almost immediately translatable into physics. I think of a point, and you say, well, it's going to move in a way that it goes two in this direction for every one it goes up. Then you say, it's going to go two to one, but immediately that one is going to start decreasing according to some formula that you establish. And those actually can usually be written up very neatly in equations. He was actually more interested in the geometrical figures, in part because he thought that the mathematics he was developing was going to treat all of physical nature as essentially mechanical, that it can be conceived of as line segments, some of them connected to one another, some of them rotating one around the other, all subject to rigorously understandable forces. But this, again, is something he learned how to master in the mid-1630s, but early in his career, and all I can do is, I'll let you pass this around. It's on page 63, in case you lose the marker. This is a so-called proportional compass. You have to imagine that it's got a lines yx and yz. Y is here. This is yx. That's yz. Y is a pivot point. So basically, you have to imagine like two sticks as long as you like. In fact, that's one of the issues here. How can you arrange it mechanically so you can extend it as you need it? And basically, you've got a pivot point, and you're increasing it and decreasing it. But the real secret is that there are a bunch of other sticks variously fixed and pivoted between them. And you'll see some dotted, they're not dotted here. There are some dotted lines, yes. There are circular lines. The circular lines are essentially describing what happens to a fixed point. Here, for example, I think B, D, F, H are, no, that's not right. What is going on here? It's a little bit too complicated to explain without putting it up and actually having a couple. So you have some of these interior sticks arranged with some slide along and others pivot. And what you can do, if, at least in the imagination, if not actually, though, you could put a pencil on one of these points, B, D, F, H, and as you expanded this thing, or basically holding one as your foot as fits, and then expanding the other, and you have a pencil tracing a curve, you'd actually be producing a curve, an algebraic curve, its graph, and that equation might be second dimension, or third, or fourth, or fifth. In fact, there's no limit in principle to, in theory. Mechanically, there is a problem here. It becomes very unwieldy very quickly, and the lubrication is an immense problem of it. But basically, you're creating an instrument that can produce like fifth, sixth, seventh dimensional curves, which the ancients were not able to produce. Why not? They restricted their constructions to what? Straight edges and compasses, which allowed you to draw circles. But these are rigorous machines that have rigorous proportions to one another and produce, as a result, rigorously determinable lines. So the geometry corresponds to the algebra, and the algebra corresponds to the geometry. Descartes thought that correspondence was far more perfect than it turns out to be. Algebraic equations can only approximate. Given a random curve, algebraic equations can only approximate, unless it happens to be one of the curves that is exactly an algebraic curve. So, for example, there are curves we can write that use sines, cosines, trigonometric functions that can only be approximated by algebraic curves. He thought actually all curves could be generated, and that was a wonderful insight. Why? It was a mistake that immediately led people to try to contradict him, which led to new scientific discoveries. At UD, I'm going to let you go on a break now, but at UD, I'm going to complain about UD a couple of times more. At UD, we have a tendency to favor the ancients over the moderns. And maybe in terms of general wisdom, that's true, although I also like to say, you know what we do? We privilege our very, very favorite ancients. And it isn't much a group much larger than, Thucydides, Plato, Aristotle, and Cicero. A few dramatists, too. The average Athenian on the street, or even someone like Heracles, I'm not sure they'd be quite as welcome as the others. So we take our favorite ancients. And so that's actually a distortion of the understanding of the ancient world. But there are some respects. Mathematics undergoes an explosive development in the course of the 17th century. What was literally unimaginable and inconceivable to the ancients becomes science. It is one of the greatest intellectual achievements, and one that the ancient mathematicians, although they would have had grounds perhaps to disagree with some of the principles on which it was built, they certainly would have been full of admiration of the result, and then would probably have tried to replicate it with the parameters of their own approach to mathematics, if we create a kind of counterfactual conversation between ancient mathematicians and modern ones. So by the time you get to 50 years later, you've had Leibniz and Newton develop the differential and integral calculus, which would not have been possible without the analytic geometry that was developed by Fermat and Descartes. If Descartes had died at age 10, Fermat still would have produced a mathematics, although the controversies between them, once again, did serve to, the competition, really, in this case, did serve to refine and perfect the science much more quickly.
Yeah, what were the questionable means on which the scientific revolution was built? Like, you had a pinpoint at, that the ancients, you said, would be critical of, maybe, even though they would accept the result. What are the means that...
The problem that modern science poses is that people who don't know what they're doing can easily use it. I mean, I think the problems largely stem from that. The science of the ancients was an elite undertaking, and was almost necessarily so. It was beyond the capacity of virtually anyone, and certainly could it be made practical only by the elite mathematicians. I mean, Archimedes, after all, is one of the few great engineers
The great engineers of antiquity are the great mathematicians. So we have such powerful mathematics and science today, you can literally pull it off the shelf. You don't have to pull it off the shelf anymore. You just call it up on your computer. You can do all sorts of things. And you don't have to give a second thought to what the foundations are of it or to what its larger consequences will be.
What's wrong with that? The criticism?
What's wrong with that? We have an immense power to act thoughtlessly, to act effectively and thoughtlessly. And you could say that, you know, Socrates in the ancient world is the great proponent of the notion that no matter how much you know, you never know enough to determine what you need to do next. I mean, I think that's very, very, very much the wisdom of his ignorance. He knows plenty of things, but he doesn't know how to get from here to there with certainty. There are always some gaps. And so that's the difference between knowledge. Knowledge is never sufficient for acting wisely. We have immensely powerful knowledge, and we have an ever lesser ambition to aspire to wisdom. Wisdom is just a word, whereas science and its power is everywhere. So I see the problem is we act thoughtlessly, and we don't worry about it at all. And it won't, by the way, it won't do to create an ethics committee at a university or a hospital or a biology lab in order to take care of this, because ethics has to be... Ethics comes from, two words, ethos and ethos. One means basically the habit of virtue. The other means the place where one lives. And so you have to acquire the virtue personally, and it has to be effective in the place where you live. But it's been the ambition of Western science to create a science which is effective anywhere, at any time, for any purpose whatsoever. That's the aspiration of universality. Universality without locality. At least the slogan that says, to think globally and to, what is it, live locally?
Gosh, what is that?
It's to think universally, but to remember that you live in here and now. You're not an eternal. You're not an immortal being. So I don't think it really was possible in antiquity to have a character like Aubrey Gray, who's a University of Cambridge, a biologist who is funding, what is he called? Something like the Methuselah Project, where he wants to defeat death by genetic manipulation. And I think the man is crazy, but it's not possible in this world, really, to say that effectively, because there are so many other people. It's perhaps just a denial of death. And I don't care if you put it off 100 years or 200 years or 1,000 years, you're still a mortal being. We'd all like to live a few years longer, being able to ski in Aspen and Vail. Maybe that will be possible. Or maybe in 10 years we'll all be running around with weapons trying to eke out our lives as our civilization collapses. But with that, a good time to take a break.
When would you like us back?
How about in, we could take another, I can have a short, relatively short session. I'll want to go to 9:05. A short break and a discussion after that. So
when do we get back?
10 minutes now?
10?
15? I don't know. What, an hour?
No.
8:25. Okay,
8:25.
Is there a clock here? No. So it's anyone's guess. I show 8:12. I'm sure I'm going to have 8:01, 8:30.
Oh, great.
So, I think you've heard, I think I've mentioned my complaints about our favorite ancients. Yeah, and what we don't like about them, we turn them into what we like.
So,
basically a Dakota ring.
It's amazing you can blow up a city with the push of a button.
Yeah, sort of poison the city with maybe a beat or a half machine.
I think especially as a philosopher of technology, I can't think of the name, like, oh, some philosopher of speed. The marshmallow gun analogy or something like that?
No, I'm not.
He says basically that I can throw a marshmallow at you in particles, but then if I increase the speed, eventually I can kill you with marshmallows.
Right. Was he an Italian?
I think he's French. Yeah. I think he's following on the heels of a wolf.
Oh, okay. Yeah, I thought. Okay.
I appreciate the lecture.
There's more to come. Even a few words about the Baroque.
Oh. Baroque science. I just don't. There's no such thing. Well, shall I turn? No, I'm going to leave that going because I'll forget to turn it back on. So who do you and do you like talking about? I mean, like, people like they are. And what persons do you do?
I'm sorry?
Yes, what is that question? Well, okay. Well, I mean, in your teaching, who do you talk about a lot? Who do you like talking about? And what courses do you do it in? And what proportion?
Well, I always like talking about Aristotle.
Oh, okay.
Because I always think that Aristotle gives you a good first approximation beyond common sense for getting a grip on issues.
I'm saying you're actually moderns.
Here, I mean, some of what I like to talk about is, one reason I like to talk about Descartes just about anywhere is that he's an all-purpose whipping boy for all sorts of intellectuals.
Yes.
We just happen to have one of the most bizarre ways of whipping them.
and you try to stick up for
them. Yeah. I increasingly like Kant, especially for trying to induce a kind of moderation about our claims for what we can know. And I think not just for here, but I think a good dose of Kant is needed currently in almost every discussion of the limits or the lack of limits of science. Or the rights of religionists to proclaim about scientific issues. I don't say that Kant is the last word, but he certainly is. I think he's to put it comparably, if you give a second thought to the issues of the relationship between science and religion, he's one of those figures that you have to consider as having thoughtfully reflected on why each has to be kept safe from the depredations of the other, and having some principles on which the two can be kept separate.
Mm-hmm.
When it comes to 20th, I always like teaching Heidegger, although I like Heidegger less and less. I like teaching Nietzsche, but I'm not Nietzsche. Nietzsche is fun because you can make almost anything. Has done. And one a point I like to make when I teach is you have to be even more careful with Nietzsche than perhaps any other relatively recent philosopher. I like some. I don't have enough time to pursue some things. I mean, I'd like to know more about Gilles Deleuze than I do. There's a still living. He's in his mid 60s. A philosopher named Michel Badiou, who is
I've heard the same or not.
Who's another physician. But he's a metaphysician in the ancient sense. His metaphysics is mathematical. Although Deleuze is similar, except he draws metaphysical consequences from topology, and Badiou draws it from set theory. But you know, in a way similar to how the Pythagoreans developed a philosophy, and in a certain sense, ancient mathematics was behind a good deal of philosophical speculation at the time. And they're genuinely metaphysicians. So metaphysics isn't really dead. It's gone back to one of its origins, that is trying to think the mathematical, but from the different modern basis that we have for mathematics.
So these are well.
Another one I like, Bergson is someone I like very much. I think he's subject to extraordinary neglect.
Well, I suppose here people would take their cue from the Manitan and people like that and say it's a waste of time, he missed the boat, or he never understood what these different categories did. So it's all at St. Thomas anyway.
It's all St. Thomas.
Well, now what about
Marischal and Lonergan? Lonergan I like, except Lonergan's, there's no way to teach insight. It's 800 pages of 500 words per page. It's almost half a million words.
Yes, he certainly needs someone who's. Well, I guess.
I have read every word, but even some words two or three times. I actually whipped a class through about 500 pages of it one time. It was a graduate course. It was a graduate course. It was considered a recovery of the philosophical tradition. And so we spent 3 weeks reading 500 pages or so of that work. Now, the point was, well, someone had complained that we didn't teach enough Catholic philosophers. And I actually got Fritz to say, and there really aren't any Catholic philosophers of the rank of a Wittgenstein. Or a Heidegger, which was a good backup. Right? But he thought, well, I mean, even though he was not in any sense a transcendental Thomist, Fritz really respected Lonergan.
Oh, is that so?
And so, you know, he really supported the idea of pushing Lonergan. If there was going to be a Catholic philosopher,
well, this was
Lonergan.
A while back.
Yeah, this was. It was in the early 90s.
Yeah.
I already had tenure, too, so it didn't matter.
Yeah, right. But now, are there any other 17th century people?
Occasionally. I want to do more with white events. It all kind of reminds me of those two plans. Of course, for next fall. I'm thinking of teaching either what is rationalism, which would basically be Descartes, Spinoza, and white events, and a little bit of Christian Wolff at the end. Or alternatively, to pit empiricism against rationalism. I did a version of this a long time ago. About thinking just doing Locke against Leibniz. And you know, Leibniz did a new Essays Concerning Human Understanding.
I didn't know.
Which is a commentary on Locke's work. And he intended, he didn't publish it during his lifetime because Locke died in the course of Leibniz's composition of it. And he did not believe it would be fair-minded to make it public once, at least during his lifetime.
Uh-huh.
But he wanted to publish it and then create a kind of conversation with Locke about
interesting.
The limits of empiricism. And it also becomes very clear why, in his own way, in Anglo-American circles, of course, people say, even outside, people tend to say, well, the notion of semiotics starts with, in an important sense, with Locke. He uses the word. It's one of those claims that people make. Is that, yeah, he uses the word, and he doesn't understand it in a way that is anywhere close to modern semiotics.
He uses the word semiotics.
This is honor. He thought that we need to have more general a logic, which he called semiotic. But he doesn't say enough about it, first of all, to really justify the kinds of claims that this is beginning for. And of course, there's Leibniz, who is the founder of modern symbolic, the mathematical approaches to logic. And in a certain sense, you could argue he's learning, he's interested in science, at least implicitly, and their value, and their systematic relationships to one another. And that's one of the things that I'm interested in, is how the different conceptions of language and the necessity or not of language, or at least symbolization, in order to bespeak the world conceptually. So that would give me a chance to work back until the problem with Leibniz is, there isn't the masterwork of Leibniz. His philosophy is scattered throughout thousands of letters and occasional writings. There's a discourse on metaphysics, the monadology, the theodicy, but the first two are sort of sketches, and they don't make a lot of sense. The discourse on metaphysics, I think, does stand on its own. Monadology doesn't. And theodicy is in many ways too specialized for to take it as the masterwork, even though it's the longest single work. But I've got to. There are things I need. I sort of need to do about Descartes too before I become too infirm to remember what they are or to be able to execute them. But my book on imagination has to be finished, I think, by the end of the summer. It's much too long. That's one thing I'm going to be doing soon. I'm going to start trimming it. I mean, I'm using 1.5 spacing. I have about 100 pages on Aristotle and 100 pages. Well, it's 100 pages on pre-Socratics and Plato. But it's just any publisher is going to look at it and say, there's no market for this. I would really hate to lose a lot of Plato, because I think Kathleen is one. Don't try to refuse. Small intellectual audience.
That is true.
What I try to do is show that Plato isn't a rationalist, at least not of any ordinary kind. At least that is, the notion of imagination is immensely subtle. And if you read, I know something we read all the time, read books 6 and 7, where you have the image of the sun and the divine line and the allegory of the cave, and then the philosophical education leading up to dialectic. It's not just that it proceeds by very heavily using metaphors and imagery, but that when you get to the end, you begin scratching your head and saying that maybe what he's done is, in the philosopher's education, a lot of people will say, well, what you do is you get more and more generalized and universal, moving away from the concreteness of this world. And actually, as you follow it through, he's making it more concrete. I mean, it goes from, arithmetic to geometry to stereometry, the three-dimensional geometry, to astronomy, that took geometry into motion. Then harmony he introduces as introducing sound as opposed to vision. And he's actually, what he's trying to do is he's trying to create an image of the world, an image of the cosmos, an image of the cosmos which is as accurate as possible and is also understood, not merely as a possibility, but in the sense of an image. And that's what dialectic is meant to do, to understand this world as not just a possible expression of ideas, but in a sense as the necessary expression. What I do is I try to push this very hard, but the fact is there is this image of the cosmos that you end up with that is justified by dialectic. And I've seen no one who has emphasized the increasing concrete representational value of it as you ascend through philosophical education. It's as though they should have philosophers that get more abstract, more and more abstract, of course. How could they conceive any differently? So, and it's connected with what I tell students when they read it. Plato isn't telling you that object is to go out of the cave. I mean, all that is, it's all in a sense an image of, the whole work is an image of the soul. It's about the soul, not about the cities. The city is an image of the soul. It doesn't mean that there's not plenty of theory about the city in it as well, but frequently enough where you have distortions in an understanding of cities, they're much more understandable if you that you see it as a representation of the soul. And so we never really get out of the cave, is the point. We're always in the cave, even when it's certain parts of us can see the other. But maybe we can never see the sun. And we can see our lesser lights as, in a sense, images of the most powerful lights, less perfect picture, less powerful, less powerful. But the shadows on the wall are not nothing. They're not nothing. What the problem is, people who sit there thinking that's all there is, and spending all their time concentrating on those things, and diagramming the movements, and figuring out the laws of those movements, and shadows on the wall. With no depth, no, it's the world with no depth dimension. But I'm so attached to that that I don't see any way I can sacrifice that. But I will. I will.
Publishing is a separate thing.
Maybe. I mean, short books are all the time. And 100 pages of one and a half space, and it's 140 pages when I read the double space.
Yeah. Yeah.
If I put that together with Aristotle, I've got a book that would be, say, 160, 75 pages. And that might be, if I think, the whole thing, except for the next time to publish it.
Okay.
Okay. Now, I'm not going to tell you about the whole rest of Descartes' life. I'm going to say a bit more about this work, the Discourse on Method. When the Discourse on the Method of rightly conducting the reason in the search for truth, I always insist that my students say the Discourse on the Method, not Discourse on Method. It's just my personal pet peeve. Or maybe just the discourse. For all of this emphasis that I put on mathematics, and if for no other reason, Descartes needs to be memorialized and esteemed for his creativity as a mathematician. He did not think of this himself this way when he was 25 years old. But he does say that he went to war. Of course, in fighting wars back then, there was far less fighting than there was sitting around waiting for a battle. And of course, they didn't fight during the winter. And it's during the winters that he has these periods of reflection. So he starts telling us about how probably in the winter of, I guess it was 1619, because he mentions the coronation of an emperor. The Emperor Frederick was coronated in Frankfurt in August of 1619. So that's probably the immediately preceding summer, this bivouacking in the winter of 1619-1620. That's a year after having been in Holland and having had a chance to meet Beckmann. And after leaving Beckmann, he seems, in fact, to have discovered the power of his early mathematical method. And he began to see it as a method for solving all problems. That is, all problems could be, I won't say reduced to figures, but all problems have elements expressed in figures and the proportions. Because there are proportions between the things, you can symbolize them by proportions between figures, or simply use letters or other sorts of representations to be a kind of reminder of relations that the problem that are necessary for solving the problem. In fact, initially he proposes this whole method to aid the imperfections of sense perception and memory and imagination.
That is, by putting something down on paper and then labeling it, even if you have to focus on other elements of the problem. And at one point he said, you know, we really can only put two things together at once. So you concentrate on one pair of relations and then another pair and another pair as you start searching for solutions. Although then the wonderful thing about algebra is you can put A's, B's, C's, X, Y, Z's, X prime, X double prime, X triple prime, as many unknowns and as many as you like in a single equation. That is, you can represent innumerable relationships in a single formula. But for him, it only meant something because it referred back to visualizable things, which in their turn stood for the elements of the problem being dealt with, whatever that problem was. And even early on, he began saying that, you know, there are certain questions, like those having to do with purely spiritual matters, that couldn't be solved by this technique. Though there's also something very interesting in his earliest notebooks. He seems to think that there is more than an accidental basis for poetic expression, putting real relationships in a figurative manner. So he said it's not perhaps surprising that wind is a material thing that is used as a symbol of the advent of the spirit. Not that the exact quantification of it was important, but that, in fact, some things that were part of the corporeal, physical world could be used to express spiritual significance. He has one note, which probably is around the time, around 1620 or so, in which he says, isn't it amazing how poets can, like sparks from flint, emit these fulgurations, these lightning flashes of insight that a philosopher can manage at best to do by plodding step by step and very laboriously. And there almost seems to be a kind of poet envy in that kind of expression. Now I told Dr. Maddox that I mentioned the Baroque there. I did. one thing that is very important for Baroque architecture in particular is a mastery of a mathematics that goes beyond that of the straight edge and the compass. For instance, if you're up on the Quirinal Hill in Rome, within half a block of one another, you have what? You have Bernini's. San Carlo al Quirinale. And then you, I'm sorry, it's Sant'Andrea al Quirinale, and there's Borromini, San Carlo alle Quattro Fontane, St. Charles at the Four Fountains. And it's not hard to find, well, it can be if there's lots of traffic and trucks parked to find the Four Fountains, but some of them are pretty small. If you go in, both of them are based on, well, either ellipses or higher degree mathematical curves, the basic ground plan of it. Now, it's not exactly true to say that it would have been inconceivable to try to design something like that previously, but increasingly the techniques available to architects and engineers were more supple and modern, and allowed them to solve problems. First of all, to sketch things out and to begin worrying about how to provide support for structures that were largely unfamiliar, certainly on the scale that they began to be used. Of course, architecture has always had to deal with oddities and curves. In the life. It's not always the easiest thing in the world to produce a section of a perfect sphere, for example. Most domes are not perfect spheres, but often enough because you have different rows of, say, bricks or other elements being smaller and smaller circles, and you can't have the kind of curve you want. Concrete is much better for that. But that doesn't come around. Reinforced concrete doesn't come around until the middle of the 19th century.
a kind of rediscovery of what the Romans had known, although steel reinforced concrete is brand new.
Maybe it isn't surprising from what I've said that Descartes, if he was a philosopher, was inevitably going to come to the question of what really, how can you justify the relationship between, say, the geometry, mathematics, analytic geometry that he was doing, and reality? His metaphysics accomplishes that. In fact, I think his metaphysics, to my taste, it's rather too effective. He arrives at it too easily. It turns out that space is essentially three-dimensional geometry. Just as there's a continuity of space, you can see so there's a continuity of matter. So you never have a vacuum. He's Aristotelian in that sense. Aristotle doesn't have a vacuum, even though he renounced many conceptions of Aristotle, especially with respect to physics and metaphysics. There is a continuum, and that means that the mathematics that he's describing of point movements would correspond to not even the movement of atoms, the movement of literally indivisible parts. He also had a theory, not entirely correct once again, though in some ways there are some very vague anticipations of what's become fractal mathematics. One example of fractal mathematics is if you take a photo of the seashore, say the Pacific seashore of the United States. And you'll notice, of course, there's a limit of resolution to that, and that's one of the issues here. It'll have a certain curvature to it. Now, one fractal question is, what's the real length of the boundary between the sea and, say, just the coast of California at any moment? And you might say, well, you know, we can approximate it. But then you realize, well, actually, the water at every moment it changes because the water waves are coming in and moving back all along the shore differentially. And you say, we might be able to average it. But even if you look at a small length of this, and you notice how there's foaming and the like, you say, well, it's really actually it's not a straight line at all. It's a really complex curve, maybe almost jagged in some ways at any given moment. And in fact, what you discover is that if you take that picture from space, and then you take a picture from maybe just 10 miles up, and another one from 1 mile up, and then you start getting down within a few feet of it, and then you use a microscope, what you discover is self-similarity is what it's called. That is, the curvature at every dimension turns out to resemble the curvature at every other. The one thing that means, as you go down more and more microscopically, the length of the coastline actually keeps increasing. Because wherever it looked macroscopically as though there was sort of a straight line, you discover a very jagged sort of, like, and then any part of that is very jagged rather than straight. So you can be doubling, quadrupling, quintupling very easily at every level the length of it. Now, one thing, Descartes' mathematics is very much based on the notion that you can, scaling up and down, in no way changes the nature of reality. So we can, I wrote a book on Descartes' imagination, and I don't want to feature imagination here today, but part of it is based on this simple notion that analytic geometry is the most rigorous form of imagining conceived by humankind. That is, a very exact notion of figuration and a description of that figuration, a formulation in a way that you can trace what we call every point of it. Not even that, but you can generate it by a moving point. According to a formula, and you can create devices that generate that curve. And anything that you discover at this scale, well, this amount of space can be taken as an imaginative representation of any other space, no matter how large or how small. It's equivalent to taking, say, the space around an atom and then sort of blowing it up.
into a macroscopic dimension and then showing the relationships there. Or the relationship of everything in the Milky Way galaxy and portraying it as though it's just in a little box here. There's a kind of self-similarity to space, and not just that, but the matter at every level follows the same laws. And that meant to Descartes that, well, in a sense, it didn't matter whether you were talking about the movement of a point or the movement of an atom or the movement of a huge sphere. Basically, each was reducible to the others. You could analyze, if you had a gross motion, you could describe that as the motion of many parts. And you only needed to divide it as far as necessary. Although God, and Descartes says this literally, God himself does, he calculates it all in essence. God knows it down to its infinitesimal dimension. And that's a kind of anticipation of a theme that comes up in Leibniz, who is, if there is a Baroque philosopher, Leibniz, I think, counts more than any other single philosopher. Or maybe it's Byzantine. His philosophy is extremely complex. But see, that's part of the, if I may call it this, it's an inappropriate term in a political sense, but I want to use it a little bit more culturally. There's an ideology to the Baroque which has to do with the relationship between appearance and what lies behind the appearance. Now, in one sense, what Descartes' philosophy says is every level of appearance is like every other level. And so what appears macroscopically is also microscopic, and also macroscopic on a much, much larger dimension as well. But nevertheless, there are relationships, there are often complex relationships behind the most simple appearances. We can have a relatively simple appearance that if we're asked to produce it formulaically would require a very complex equation. And the Baroque, especially Baroque architects, play with this very, very much. You'll often go, for instance, in those two churches on Quirinal, the one by Bernini, the other by Borromini, you'll walk into them, and they have a kind of Renaissance sense of balance, but you realize, as you look very carefully, especially if you've had a good architecture, history of architecture instructor, or a person who took you on a walking tour in Rome, and explained these things to you, and then took you back and showed you the plan and how it worked, you realize that it's not using the Renaissance devices. It's using devices which are far more complicated in terms of curvatures, the use of masses and the like, and yet quite remarkable kinds of balance are achieved that are very much like the Renaissance. But of course, not all, some Baroque designs are in fact very flamboyant. They are very energetic as well. And it's as though the imagination of the architects of the Baroque period was, the imaginations were released by these far more powerful and sophisticated mathematical techniques. In a sense, what I want to point out is, it's not as though they all had VisiCalc that they could run on their computers. They didn't have computers. In fact, solving problems mathematically was still an immensely laborious job. A calculator was a person, not a machine. Although Pascal invents the first working calculator that was going to work for very long. By the way, Descartes saw it. He met Pascal, I believe, in the summer of 1647. Had a number of conversations with him, liked him very much, but they disagreed very much, very strongly on the nature of the vacuum, because Descartes didn't believe there was such a thing. Okay. But you know, the barometer that they devised is based on creating a vacuum. You fill a column of glass with mercury and then put it upside down in a pool of mercury, and so that there's no air in there, but the mercury descends and the air pressure is pushing up. But then that there's a vacuum there. Descartes insisted that subtle spirits, that subtle matter, penetrated the sides and drove it down. And he even suggested an experimental test, which he thought would prove there were subtle experiments, if you did it at a higher altitude and the pressure was less. It turns out he was right that the pressure was going to be less, but it has nothing to do with it. his explanation. And in fact, a couple of years later, they began performing those experiments. But Descartes was dead by the time that was done. Enough of the Baroque. Let's worry about this work. See, one thing I want to point out, in any kind of history narrative, historians always lie. I've dabbled at history, so I know this firsthand. And my wife's a historian, too. Of course, the tradition began with Herodotus, although Herodotus didn't call himself a liar. He's called father of history, father of lies. But all narration, we like to think, well, there was just the way things are. Yeah, but then there's the description of what happened. We would like to reconstruct what happened, but we only have a finite number of accounts, and many of those are very imperfect. Most historians do the best they can in giving an account, though they have their primary points of focus. Now, when we're doing, especially when we're dealing with works of real substance, at UD I can use this term a little bit less self-consciously than elsewhere. Great works. The notion of canon is a little bit more respectable now than it was 10, 15 years ago in academia, I think. But there's still the sense that it's elitist. Well, I'm sorry, scientists have to, with respect to one another, act as though they live in a republic. But with respect to non-scientists, it's an aristocracy. And the same holds true in philosophy, except the students of a philosopher are not ever going to be viscounts. Okay, the princes and kings of philosophy are always going to be superior, because it has to do with something like the range of their vision, the pregnancy of their concepts. Most people who come after are trying to do mopping up operations. They're trying to fill out details, and a lot of them are just trying to understand ever more carefully the terms and the propositions of their teachers, and as a result, they scholasticize them. And I'm not talking about a particular movement in philosophy of the Middle Ages. I'm talking about all schools end up producing a kind of scholasticism, where you say, as Dr. Roseman, when I explain this to Dr. Roseman, he says, yes, I know what you mean. You go to a conference of medieval philosophy, and people will talk about Aquinas' existence and essence, yada, yada, yada. You go to a phenomenology conference, and they'll talk about intentionality and structures and noema and noeta, yada, 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 yada. The important thing is to speak the terms, but not necessarily to understand them as the real masters of thought. I think you have to say there are masters of thought. Descartes is one of them. Americans especially like, tables, who's number one, who's number two, who's number three. And then we like to have playoffs. And we get really mad when we can't have playoffs between the great philosophers. Sometimes polls, and there's something ridiculous about polls are taken. Kant usually ends up being first, second, or third. Aristotle usually ends up in the top five, and so does Plato. So it's interesting, that's all people, whether they're analytic philosophers or continental philosophers or even people who are not Western, those people typically will be in the top five, let's say, three of the top five. Descartes is almost certainly to be in the top ten. I like to say, let's work by 20. There are 20 people in the West who are indisputably great philosophers. Descartes is one of them. They all can't be equally right about all things, but I like his first approximation to say that reality is sufficiently encompassing, it is sufficiently grand, it is sufficiently subtle, that maybe it's not such a bad idea to think of the great philosophers as divine men with the elements, except they're not completely blind. And they do remarkably well with the abilities and the situation they have. Aristotle, I always think people ought to think starting about almost any problem with Aristotle. Not necessarily if it's modern form of physics, but if you're thinking about nature, for example, why? Because Aristotle always starts with, first of all, in matters that everyone experiences, with what everyone says, with common sense. And then he also considers what all of the learned have said about learned subject matters before him. And he tries to sort out what is right from what is wrong, and then always to start over himself. And that makes him, first of all, a real philosopher as opposed to a real scholar of philosophy or historian of philosophy. Now, great historical works, like the Discourse, they have their own specific density. They have their own, Umberto Eco, in a couple of his works, talks about certain works have a kind of closure to them, which is not to say, but others have a kind of openness. The really great works have an openness. In a sense, as much as you think you may have them pinned down, there are riches that you haven't discovered. And when those works are treated in a history course, the problem is a history course always has to use them to illustrate, say, the Baroque era, or to illustrate philosophy in the 17th century. And what that does, that's fine when you're dealing with a philosopher of the third or fourth rank. The third or fourth water, I sometimes say. I don't want to say rate, third or fourth rate philosophers. I'd be happy to be a fourth rate philosopher if there are 20 great, 400 at the second level, 8,000 at the third, and then 160,000 at the next level. I'd be perfectly happy to be. Third rate would be wonderful. Third rate. I want to treat this work as a kind of open work. As making claims about truth, about the way things are. Obviously, no philosopher is going to be absolutely right, not even Thomas Aquinas, sorry. I have to say this, and I'm actually going to say what I have to say about Descartes in about 15 minutes. But I have to say this about UD. Lots of people know a lot about Descartes. Lots of people think they know a great deal about Descartes. There are many different approaches to Descartes. Descartes is one of the classic whipping boys in intellectual histories and histories of philosophy. You know, feminists are against him, and libertarians are against him, and Democrats, not contemporary American Democrats, are against him. You know, because he just seems to be too happy with a monarchical regime. Go along, get along, seems to be the principles that he expresses there. Anti-rationalists hate him. Okay. So that means empiricists hate him, because he does all of his science from the top down. It isn't true, but most of these claims aren't true, or they're not anywhere near as true as they're said. UD has a particularly fairly commonplace and very pernicious interpretation. My wife, who is an expert in the 16th and 17th century, and knows a lot about intellectual history, in fact, says, tell your students this. If they go out to the world and spout that Descartes is insincere, he's a closet atheist, his metaphysics is a smokescreen, you will be treated as bizarre. It is a very minority position. It's a very minority position. And I think it's just factually wrong if you know anything about the nature of Catholicism and belief in the 17th century. If you doubt me, Alan Kors, K-O-R-S, historian at the University of Pennsylvania. He is one of the founders of the National Association of Scholars, which is sort of the conservative right-wing professional organization, general professional organization, contrasted with the AAUP. He wrote a book about atheism in France. The dates are something like 1649 to 17... It's in the teens, I think. Its basic argument is really there are no atheists at all in Europe until the beginning of the 18th century. And you say, that can't possibly be true. Well, you can argue it. One thing, you have free thinkers, people who were considered to be immoral were often labeled atheists. Okay, that's one thing. It was an epithet to condemn those people you disagreed with. But the course... more basic argument is extremely interesting, because what he shows is that atheism was produced
as a respectable philosophical position by the anti-atheists. What? The anti-atheists, wanting to accuse the people they dislike of atheism, they scoured their works, they found passages they found problematic, they not only presented them, but they made arguments that weren't made in the original that were much better arguments for atheism. In fact, it's the anti-atheists who produced the strong arguments for atheism and made it respectable. So if you're against a certain heresy, beware of the way in which you try to suppress it. You may end up making it more attractive. That's a point to be made here. I think Descartes is perfectly serious in his conception of God. In fact, I'd make this claim. I don't entirely agree with Kant's dismissal of all proofs of the existence of God as failures. But I think that if you know what it means to prove something, and Descartes is someone who knew what it meant to prove something, at least in mathematics, that there really aren't many proofs of God in the history of the West that even approach the rigor of Descartes' proofs. Not the one you have here, it's a summary that you have in the fourth part, the one he has in the Meditations. In comparison, Thomas Aquinas is a piker. The five ways are flimsy and shabby arguments. They are in comparison. Now the thing is, you have to have someone who knows what Descartes is doing in that proof. And what he's doing is he's extending the notion of proportionality. This is all I'll say about the proof of the existence of God. I do like to say this. If you understand and accept, understanding is the first thing, the distinction he makes between formal reality and objective reality in an idea. You're going to write this down. I'm not going to tell you what this is. He does make this. Oh, well, I can very quickly tell you what it means. If I can think horse, I can think squirrel. If this isn't how Descartes explains it, but I think it's an adequate, quick representation of it. As a thought of mine, it takes about as much intellectual stuff to think horse as it does squirrel. So they're equal in terms of what he calls formal reality, pretty much. In fact, all ideas, if we think of what is comprehensively occupying our mind at every given moment, and at the next moment, and at the next moment, because it's all our mind state, it pretty much has the being of the state of our mind, and that's pretty much equal from moment to moment. So all of our ideas, the reality of that idea, just as a thing, an idea, is about the same. But what those things represent are different. You know, a horse is different from the representative or objective reality is different. Now, suppose I say this. Okay, think a squirrel. Now, think a squirrel sitting, eating an acorn under an oak tree with a horse next to him. Does that idea have more representative reality than just the squirrel? And you might say, well, maybe, because it's the squirrel plus. Okay. Now I say, think of all of that in Irving County, Dallas County. And then think of Texas, encompass and everything it encompasses, all the particular things, all the squirrels, horses, and everything else. And now think of the United States, and now think of the terrestrial globe, and now think of the solar system, and now think, am I not increasing the representational reality? So if you accept that there is formal reality in ideas, it's basic that it's an idea, it is something as such, and has a reality as such, but also what it represents has a much more differential reality. And then, if you accept the real crux of the proof of the existence of God is that we are capable of conceiving a positive infinity. If Descartes is right in saying that, his proof works. In fact, we should all be worship. We should all philosophically understand that there is an eternal, almighty creator God. By the way, that goes far beyond the God of the philosophers before Descartes. for a very fascinating account of Descartes against the background, his previous background, but essentially, but also against a deep medieval, ancient medieval problem, basically the problem of infinity. You have to read Hans Blumenberg, the legitimacy of modernity. In fact, the book argues, it's a very long one, but it are a legitimacy of modernity. In the conflict between the ancients and the moderns, Blumenberg says, the ancients aren't playing the same game. There is a distinctive legitimacy to the problems that are being addressed by modernity. And he sees Descartes as being crucial here because, he says, in fact, he says that the medieval problem, the way in which the so-called medieval synthesis of Thomas Aquinas was exploded by so-called nominalism, which is too simple a term, but we still use it. Everyone say boo because I mentioned nominalism. Hooray, Thomas Aquinas. Said the problem that the medieval synthesis ran aground precisely on the problem of infinity that was inadequately resolved in late antiquity. The problem of infinity largely arose through the influence of Christianity on philosophy. And the philosophy of the ancients did not have the conceptual apparatus to deal with the infinite. Now that's partly a mathematical and conceptual problem, but it also has to do with this. If God is truly infinite, that means he is also, there is no proportion between God and us. We are finite. So it's like everything's a zero. We're essentially zero. But that creates a problem, especially when you think, well, then why in any sense should what holds for God bind him with respect to us? In particular, why should the world be understandable at all? And why should, in fact, the morality we accept be understood as rational? I mean, in a sense, at least some nominalists argued, why are the commandments what they are? It's because God said so. Not because reason reveals it to be true. It's because God is almighty and he says so. And what Blumenberg argues, and there's actually a his name's not coming to me at the moment. There's also a Baltz, I just know his first initial, A. Baltz, B-A-L-C, who has a book, which makes a similar sort of argument about two decades before Blumenberg. I don't know that there's any connection. He says that what Descartes does is he takes this problem head on, and what he does is he, in fact, resolves the problem. So in a sense, you get the Thomistic results with infinity. You get a strange simulacrum of the truths that Thomas arrives at, and nevertheless, God is understood as so infinite that he is infinitely beyond us. Indeed. One thing, if there's nothing else to know about Descartes, it would be this. In a letter he wrote to his friend from school, the College of Henry IV in La Flèche, who then set himself up in Paris and ended up becoming a correspondent with everyone who knew anything. So if you were an intellectual who went to Paris, you went to see Mersenne. And when you weren't in Paris, you wrote to Mersenne, and then Mersenne directed your letter to someone else who would be interested in it, comment on it. So he was a kind of intellectual exchange service. He wrote to Mersenne and basically said that the world is understandable, but it's not understandable because God is bound by laws. God is bound by nothing. God is not even bound by the principle of non-contradiction. That is, even the most extreme nominalists of the Middle Ages would not have said that. They would have said he is bound by the principle of non-contradiction. What Descartes did say, though, is the only limit to God is that God can do or be nothing that makes him not God. And you say, but that's an application of the principle. No, it's the foundation of everything. The principle of non-contradiction is true because God has made it so, and it's a kind of extension in the world that is apparent to us, the lawful world that God created for us.
the principle of non-contradiction must be true of that world. But there could be infinite number of other worlds that are different, according to the way it's been conceived. Although we can say nothing about those worlds. And we live out our lives in the world we're in. But he said the world, the laws according to which the world is created, he called them the created eternal truths. They're created by God, but they're eternal. They're eternal. That is, they're at the foundation of the universe, and as long as the universe is, they will be as well. And these, basically, knowing mathematics and knowing the science of the world is part of knowing these created eternal truths. It really is for Descartes, more than it is for a lot of later 17th and 18th century scientists, a kind of piety. It's a carrying out of we are made as rational beings. That's one of the points of the ego cogito. And whenever I say that I think, I recognize that to be true in the saying it, even, in the saying or thinking it. It's true as long as I say or think it, as long as I am conscious, as long as I'm aware of myself. And if you say, well, what about your being when you stop thinking? Then there's no evidence for it, okay? But then we need something more powerful to establish our continuity of consciousness. And if you can prove that there is a positive infinity, and if you can prove that we're imperfect and therefore cannot be the source of that infinity, he claims he can show there must be some objective, well, not our sense of object, some real infinite being beyond us. And if there's a greater infinite being beyond that, or a greater one beyond that, the ultimate one is God. And is the source of everything. And he claims that this is what you can know by natural reason. These conclusions are much more powerful than any of the conclusions of natural theology before them. People who say it's a smokescreen do not follow the proof. They do not know the method of the proof. I claim it's because they don't know how his science works. You've got to read his science to know what he's about. And if you want to know what he is about as a man, well, he was. Read the biographies. There is no autobiography of Descartes. Lots of letters, 5 volumes in French and letters, each volume running to maybe 600 or 700 pages. So there's a lot of account available in English. That's not because they're trying to keep any secrets. If you want to read them, learn French. Well, you have to learn French, you have to learn Latin, and you have to learn a little Dutch. Oh, you can actually now learn Italian because there's a comprehensive edition. Which translates, gives them all in their original languages and translates them into Italian. So you could do that too. So that would be a way to get to know them. The very last, he died in Stockholm. I'm pointing to the erased. He spent most of his life outside France, though he went back frequently to Paris and spent time there. He was never in any danger of being arrested while he was there. For any reason whatsoever, not really under any suspicion. However, he was brought to trial in Utrecht because he had a follower who drew very radical consequences, materialist consequences, which clearly Descartes is not a materialist, and certain possibly atheistic consequences. Although maybe there isn't any atheist in the 17th century. And besides that, the follower of Descartes insulted the rector of the University of Utrecht. And he brought charges against Descartes as being the originator of this. And Descartes had to work finally through the French ambassador to get the Prince of Orange to intervene and essentially to tell the provost of the university to shut his mouth and not do anything further. Although it became an extremely political, as you can see from the kind of people who were involved. And Descartes was rather, it's why one reason Descartes never liked the idea of having followers or students, because almost and every time he did, almost immediately he began writing letters to them saying, you didn't get this quite right, you didn't get quite that quite right, and sometimes unsubstantial. So he spent a lot of time there. His reputation became very widespread, although his influence already was largely scientific, especially in the Dutch universities.
modern physics. Physics was taught according to Descartes. Queen Christina of Sweden heard about him. Again, the ambassador who was to Sweden, who was a friend of Descartes, arranged for an invitation to him, and he became a tutor to Christina, a philosophical tutor. Unfortunately, she wanted him to come very early in the morning. He had never been used to rising early, not since he was a kid. He had to get up at 4 in the morning, and then at 5 in the morning, be in a sled in the winter, headed. He arrived in late September. It's already pretty cold in Stockholm. And he contracted something in January, and by February 11th, he was dead. It's said that it was pneumonia. He wrote a play while he was there. It's a kind of comedy, a mask and play, which isn't extant, but there are descriptions. There are descriptions of it. So it's sort of interesting that he did it. But just before he went, he wrote a book called The Passions of the Soul, which on the surface, it looks like what it is an application of mechanistic thinking to the human emotions. What it really is, as Descartes understands, we are, in fact, body and soul, and there has to be some interaction between them. It's original in this sense. It does not originate the notion that our moods are very much a corporeal phenomenon. That's very deeply embedded in, say, Aristotelianism and in Stoicism. And the ancient medical tradition as well. But what is unique about it is the attempt to make it modern, to give a mechanistic understanding of the physics, and nevertheless to say that somehow the soul and the body have to interact for moods to be effective. In fact, one thing he points out, let me clear that, and this is where I'm going to stop, is that one thing he points out is that, he creates a tradition, or he makes a decisive move in a tradition that had largely been a rhetorical tradition. The understanding of things like emotions and moods had been largely the province of rhetoric. It goes back to Aristotle again, and even back beyond Aristotle. What he does is he makes the study of moods a matter of moral philosophy, but also a matter of physiology. In fact, simultaneously both. That's effective. You'll find something similar in Hobbes. Even though Hobbes is born earlier, Hobbes is derivative when it comes to this theory. Hobbes scholars hate hearing that, but it's true. You also have it in Spinoza. You have it also in some of the great empiricists of Britain and also the Scottish Enlightenment, which includes some of the great empiricists of Britain. But one thing that Descartes pointed out is, he was accused by Maritain, the great neo-scholastic thinker of the early 20th century, or maybe the second-class thinker of the early 20th century, accused Descartes of angelism, saying that basically you can see the human soul is like an angel that somehow got put into a body. It is true that Descartes said that God could have put our consciousness into many different worlds. Since God created the eternal truths, he could have given us different eternal truths, and our minds would have worked differently, and then the bodies that we had in that world would have worked according to the laws of that physical universe. But what he did is he coordinated these. And what it means is that we really wouldn't be able to think well at all unless somehow moods helped reinforce the focus on certain kinds of objects. What moods do is focus us. Hatred, for example, focuses us on the object of hatred, so does love. He considers to be, in a sense, one of the most fundamental of emotions, passions, as he calls it, to be wonder. It's the philosophical passion, of course. Aristotle and Plato both said that philosophy begins in wonder, though each had slightly different notion, at least slightly different notion, of what that wonder was.
for Descartes, it meant something like this, that wonder is that power that allows us to look at the world and notice that something is different, to notice that something is new, and to be struck by that. And to be struck by that and then to want to know it. So the wonder is what gives you the focus to attend to it long enough to understand it. Now, you might say, well, that's a philosopher's virtue. But it's at work. It's at work with the other virtue, with the other virtues as well. Each of the virtues is a way of holding our attention on an object. And in a sense, God created human nature by implanting in our body particular ways of the association of consciousness and physiology. So there are certain reliable connections and other ones we can modify through living, through practice, and through accident, contingency. You know, if a spider frightens you when you're 2 years old, it might frighten you when you're 20 and when you're 40 and 60 as well. But you can do things to try to lessen that. So Descartes says that very much what we are as spiritual beings, we're not just thinking beings, we are experiencing beings. And the world we focus on and live in, according to the way in which God has implanted consciousness in the body and given it moods and passions and emotions that direct us to things in fairly characteristic ways. And then he lets us make our way through the world, finding our way with those passions and our understanding and trying to live in the best way. Now, what is the culmination? What is the culminating virtue? And he talks about the virtues in this work, the passions of the soul. He says generosity is the highest. Now, you have to take that. I'm not going to explain it in depth. In one sense, it looks sort of odd, but it also is what we think of it as. It is a kind of overflowing of the human. It's an overflowing, a recognition. For one thing, he says generosity is what allows us always to think the best of others, as we would like them to think the best of us. So if they do wrong, we should think of them that they did it for the best reasons, that it seemed to be the right thing for them. Of course, we can be wrong about them. That, but it's this kind of emotion and passion that leads us to want to share, that leads us to want to live a life together and in common, and to live according to the highest standards and to encourage others to live that way as well. If this guy was someone who just threw up smoke screens and his only goal was to further the Baconian project, that's not the guy you read about in the pages of the Passions of the Soul. So it must be that someone other than Descartes wrote the works of Descartes. One last word of advice. When you're around me, don't ever use the word the modern project, capital M, capital P. I tend to think there was a circular letter that went around. It was written by perhaps Machiavelli, and he signed it in large script, and then it went on to Hobbes, and he signed it, and Bacon signed it, and then Descartes signed it, and Kant signed it, and it's all led to the 20th century. That is the worst kind of notion. It's the worst kind of stereotype that gives intellectual history a bad name. We ought to do better. I'll take questions, but if you want to take another break, let's take questions and then
questions.
Go home.
Could you say something about either literary or cultural antecedents or contexts for Descartes' doubt? In the discourse, he doesn't really talk about where that might come from.
Yeah, and
it was certainly in the air.
Yeah. I tend to think of the doubt as more a kind of rhetorical stratagem, an argumentative stratagem. He clearly doesn't, by the time he's writing his work, he doesn't intend to make doubt universal.
Tao. In fact, he wants to show that Tao is self-defeated. Of course, the ancient skepticism had been gradually recovered along with about every other ancient movement in the course of the 16th century. The immediate antecedent, who's of considerable importance, who in fact, in decisive ways, appears on every page of the discourse, is Montaigne.
So he did read. He did.
Oh,
Montaigne.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay.
Well, in a sense, everyone did. But certainly, being educated of La Flesh, he was perfectly aware of Montaigne, even as he was not. And it never will be translated. You really have to learn French. There's an edition of the Discourse on Method that Etienne Gilson edited back in, I guess, the 1920s. It's the Discourse, René Descartes' Discours de la Méthode, text and commentary by Etienne Gilson. It's one of those books where the text is, you know, there's the text, and there's the commentary. It's basically in footnote reference form, So for every sentence, there's a kind of reference. And the most frequently cited source that Gilson discovers for many of the things that Descartes says, or since responding to his Montaigne, by far, of his predecessors. Now, that the English title of the Latin book is That Nothing Is Known by a guy named Suarez, which was published in the first decade of the 17th century. And it was a kind of casual skepticism. Oh, well, you know, the skepticism of Montaigne is sort of interesting because one thing that Montaigne is not... He has a kind of slogan, especially in the first set of essays, which is Cassation. What do I know? It's as though almost anything you can talk about, especially if it's in the past, but even things in the present you're not a witness to, even interpretation of things in your own life, you can be wrong about things. On the other hand, you are better known to yourself than anyone else. And so he's not really a deep skeptic about his self-knowledge, especially the self-knowledge that is not self-glorification. It's not expression of self-love. But it gets along with himself fine. And that actually seems, one thing, at the end of The Passions of the Soul, it almost looks as though Descartes is achieving a kind of compromise between Stoicism and Montaigne, if that makes any sense at all. What he says is reason can indeed very much guide the passions, although reason cannot command the passions. So the reason usually he points out that you can't say to yourself, stop being sad, and stop. You won't stop being sad just by doing it. You can't will it and understand that you need it. What you need to do, well, he actually counsels using the imagination, using literature and the like, read happy stories, see a comedy or the like, to counteract, because in part your body has to be affected. Moods are physical. The passions of the soul are physically produced states of mind and physically sustained ones. So you have to do something about that. I sometimes wonder what he'd do in the age of pharmaceuticals, you don't need to see a play. Instead, you pump yourself full of one drug or another to make yourself happy and counteract melancholy and depression. But you get to the end, and he answers the question, what good are the passions? Now, of course, the Stoics, the strict construction Stoics, they counsel the state you want to achieve is apatheia, lack of feeling. The only thing to become worked up about is true virtue, if you're a Stoic. That's the only thing to be passionate about. And what Descartes says instead, and this is what sounds very much like Montaigne, he says, why would God have given us all these passions? I mean, even if you just consider the basic ones, and he identifies half a dozen of them, why would he have given them to us if they were not in their way good? And so that we have to learn to live our lives in a reasonable way and to enjoy all life's sweetness. You know, that is a very un-Cartesian thought. Look at some of the very last words written by Descartes. So.
He doesn't seem very Augustinian.
Not at that moment. Although the arguments are made that what he's doing, at least initially, is producing a kind of Augustinian metaphysics and epistemology. Because Augustine never, of course, he has elements of epistemology and metaphysics, but not a thoroughgoing produced one. But Descartes was very much in Augustinian circles. Mersenne was Minim, an Augustinian influence. And he also associated it very much with the Oratorians, who were very strict construction of Augustinians. And in fact, I can't remember his name at the moment. Because it would be the founder of the Oratorians.
It's not Busley, it's not Bundle, it's
yeah, I know. Yeah, that. Yeah. We know. Well, we'll remember it. At 11, we'll remember what it is. He urged Descartes to pursue his scientific and philosophical studies in an Augustinian spirit. This was in the late 1620s. And it was apparently in 1628-29 that he actually went through the meditations that are the basis of the fourth part, this is metaphysical argument. Another thing there, it is pointed out by the proponents of Descartes as being a proponent of the modern project that he points to a kind of utilitarian ethic at the beginning of the sixth discourse. Well, but the problem is he talks about the commodiousness of life, as Veitch in his very quaint 1850 English translation. But it's commode, and commodité that he's talking about. And what that really means is apt or appropriate. You know, it doesn't mean comfortable, as sometimes it's interpreted, a commodious or rich life. It's an apt, appropriate life for the circumstances that we are put into. So that we can use our ingenuity, the ingenium, in order to find better ways to live. We can combat diseases. He thinks that's a good to be pursued. God put our soul and body together, and we need to do what we can to preserve the union of that, but recognizing it will not be eternal. There are three or four, you know, maxims. He presents a morality in the third one. I say three or four because the fourth, it's not clear whether he's summing up with the last one or it's a fourth independent one or it's just a kind of conclusion he draws. It's basically deciding to continue in the life that he's living, that is, of someone pursuing wisdom. But one thing he says, and a lot of people don't take seriously, is he says, you know, if the choice is changing the world or giving up our desire, it's easier to give up desire than to change the world. That's not what Baconian says. But I think he's very serious. He's very serious about that. For one thing, Descartes, it wouldn't make sense to spend a lot of time trying to create an iPod if it didn't conduce to your enjoying all the sweetness of life and living in a spirit of generosity and living as well as God intends us to live. I mean, I'm not saying it's incompatible. I'm just saying that he would say at some points, don't slave away at something if it's going to take you away from a more comprehensive sense of living well. God has, there is this, you have to think about this. Socrates in the Crito, if you've ever read the Crito, it's the one where it's right after the apology. He's been convicted, he's in prison, and of course the one that follows is Phaedo, in which he's given the hemlock and dies. In the Crito, comes to him and says, I've bribed the guards, I've got a fast chariot, if you go now, we can get to the next city and you'll be free. And Socrates says, well, you know, Crito, I've always said that we should always reflect on what we do before we do it. So let's
sit here together and think whether this is the best question. There's no time, Socrates, to wait. We do it now. I've lived this way all my life, and I'm going to continue living it this way. But there's, at one point, he says, look, the gods, Plato says they're going to kill you. He says, the gods have, he treats the gods as military commanders. They put me to this post. This is where I stand. Why should I think that I should be anywhere else? And although you can think about Descartes, that he says, well, he's a rationalist and the like, and therefore our true being is our thinking, you read carefully in the Meditations, you get to the sixth meditation, and he says that, yeah, our essence as thinking being is precisely thinking, but there's also the total human nature that we have, which he discusses in the sixth meditation. And that turns out to involve the passions and all the things that are not veridical. He even says there, you know, the sense, God didn't give us the senses in order to have knowledge. He gave us the senses so that we could live tolerably well in a world of things that are visible and hearable in the life. But just because it looks good doesn't assure that it's good. But for the most part, he's arranged that it is. It's nothing against God if sometimes you eat a beautiful-looking fruit and it tastes sweet and it kills you. Because he's also given us the power. First of all, our life is not of absolute value in that sense, that it has to go on forever. But in the other sense, he's also given us the ability to look into these things. Just because it looks good and it's sweet doesn't mean we have to chow down immediately on it. We can check first if we're not sure. So we should use our intelligence to live well in a comprehensive sense. But we can learn more through better living through science. But not necessarily so much science that we devote our whole life to becoming a slave of science. In a way, what he said, he seems to think a couple of generations and we'll have gotten everything we need. And I sometimes wonder whether that's just a lack of imagination about how laborious it's going to be, or whether he says, we'll understand the principles well enough at that point, and, you know, we'll make progress here and there, but we, a technological civilization, and what? What are we striving? What are we striving for there? The real pleasures of life, he says, in letters and also in the passions of the soul, tend to come through things like conversation. Now, there's, I mean, one argument to be made is that at best he had only a very approximate understanding of the passions and emotions and their significance, even at the point of writing the Meditations in 1641. In a sense, it was he was introduced to the Princess Elizabeth of Bohemia. Her father had been deposed as King of Bohemia, and she was living in Holland. She was like 19 years old at the time. And he felt she was, there were very few, he had very few true readers, people that actually read him and understood him, not just in one word, but comprehensively, and she was one of the few. And he thought it was quite remarkable. But she forced him into discussions of political philosophy and moral philosophy, sometimes to try to back out. And then the passions of the soul, in a way, grew out of the correspondence that he now, one thing he has to realize is certainly in 1619, he was a fish out of water when he was in the military. He was far more educated and cultured than almost the other officers. So it's not so surprising that he would have gone to be by himself in a warm room, the equivalent of sleeping late, so to speak. In the morning, and there wasn't much else to do, although the other officers were finding wine room and song, and Descartes was finding warm rooms in order to find the foundation for his philosophy, apparently.
One thing that's clear is he doesn't rush to do this. In fact, in the meditations, he's very clear. Once in your life, you should undertake the kind of meditation he's going to do. Once in your life, you should question all the things you hold to be true. One could say at least once in your life, but he doesn't rush into it. He says, first I have to see the world. I have to get a broader vision of things, understand how different people live. And I kept sort of planning for this, but I realized I couldn't do it in a rush, and I couldn't do it at a time when all sorts of business was urgently needed to be dealt with. There had to be a time when I was relatively free of obligation, and so he had to be free of all sorts of urgencies and also free of most passions. Although I think you're quite right. In the last analysis, he's not free of the passion of wonder. In fact, it's the cultivation of the passion of wonder from the perspective of the passions of the soul looking back. That's what he did in the work. And whether he fully appreciated that, it's hard to know. But his, he wasn't really tempted by skepticism, I think, although he saw a lot of skepticism around him. But there were lots of reasons for it. There were whenever there are many conflicting theories of what fundamental truth is, skepticism is always going to seem like a reasonable option for them. Well, if no one can agree on anything, then maybe there's no truth. But he did want to show that if you were going to be a skeptic, you needed to be a kind of consistent skeptic, a thoroughgoing skeptic, and to try to see whether there was any limit to skepticism. That's the point. He says, he keeps sort of dropping and dropping through potential truth. Maybe sensation is right, but sensation often deceives me. But you say, wait a minute, from a distance, I see a certain lighthouse as though it's circular. I get up close and see it's a 16-sided thing. So, right, you're saying one perception is true and the other is not. But remember what I said about fractals? And he already knew this. If you get closer yet, of course, it's not a perfect 16-sided figure. It's got all sorts of irregularities. So what shape is it exactly? Which of your perceptions is the veridical or truth-bearing perception? And that's where he says, fool me once, shame on you, fool me twice, shame on me. So I'm not going to be fooled by sensation because I put myself in a non-urgent situation of reflection. I'm going to say that I'm not going to accept the veridicality of perception, of sensation, until I find the standard that allows me to say that it is true, that it is true or not. And he doesn't find that till the end of it. He says he'd rather treat it as false. So it's what he calls hyperbolic skepticism. It's an excessive or exaggerated kind of skepticism that he cultivates. But when it comes down to, it actually is very simple. In the meditations, he does not say, I think, therefore, I am. That therefore, which appears both in the discourse and in a later work, The Principles of Philosophy, is illusory. He makes this clear in Descartes published the meditations in 1640, and a limited 40 books were published. It was then sent to scholars all over Europe for comment. And he asked Mersenne, his friend in Paris, to gather together objections, and that he would write replies to them. And so when it was published in 1641 into the world, there were the meditations, and it was sort of like this, the meditations took up that much, and the objections and replies took up that much. Six, seven times as much. He really was willing to cultivate criticism. He in fact made some changes because of Arnaud's. Arnaud made the only criticisms that he thought had real substance to them. He made a couple of changes as a result of that, including the subtitle, because he realized that he had not proved the immortality of the soul. He had only proved that it was possible that the soul was, or that the soul was certainly separable from the body, and therefore the possibility of immortality was established because of God's power, but not that he could actually prove it to immortal. And Arnaud has very strongly argued that point to them. Descartes produced these meditations, in a sense, to say that at some point you have to stop being a skeptic. especially when you say, when you learn how to isolate, Kant says this is impossible, but you learn how to isolate yourself from all your thoughts. Or you learn how to see yourself as distinguishable from all your thoughts. You're present in all your thoughts, except usually the object of the thought is the focus of your attention. Your self-consciousness is only there weakly in the background. What he tries to do is to ramp this up and to create a situation where you finally imagine, and it really is a kind of imagining, yourself as having ideas, but that have no reality. And then you ask, can the very idea I have of myself, as I doubt my own existence, genuinely be doubted and be nothing? And as you ramp up the, and see, this is the real key to it, I think. Imagine yourself sitting there, I doubt that I exist. I doubt that I exist. And now you try every expedient you can to conceive of yourself as thinking but not being. And then you say, and then you try harder to do that. You're thinking harder and harder, and you're actually becoming more conspicuous to yourself the harder you try to doubt yourself. It's sort of a wonderful feedback mechanism that he develops there. So his claim is, what becomes evident is you thinking being. That is, the three things are together. The you-ness, the thinking character, and the fact of being are all present there at the same moment. It's a unity which really can't be analyzed, because you can't separate the I from the being thinking, and you can't separate the being from the thinking I, and you can't separate the thinking from the being I. So it's a case where analysis doesn't really get to reality. Analysis, you can project these aspects, but what's really counts is that they're unified and all there together. And if you broke them down, you wouldn't have the phenomenon that you have. For that reason, it is right to say that in an important sense, Descartes is one of the fathers of self-consciousness. Although Montaigne's there too. Montaigne, and that is always important to remember. A very genial self-consciousness. But Montaigne cultivates always, whatever you see, remember that you're judging by the standards that you bring with you, but you can also, what you look at allows you to judge what you are. You can constantly correct your standards, but you're always bringing your standards to all of your judgments. So educate yourself ever more, and you'll have an ever more comprehensive set of standards by which you can judge not so much the world, but yourself. To come to the wonderful conclusion at the end of experience, that in the end, the greatest king of the world still sits on his own ass, to be quite literal in the translation of it. And for Descartes, the only way you can encounter being is, the true being is not in the things of the world, but to recognize that the things in the world are constantly shown to you, and then to recognize that you aren't sufficient for accounting for your own being. Since you can conceive of a positive infinity, that's a warrant that there is an act, not just a representation of positive infinity, but a real positive infinity behind it. And you can call that God. The ultimate infinity is God. And it's responsible for everything. Of course, then he finds out God is good, and therefore won't fundamentally deceive us, and therefore you can count on a certain level of science, and a lot of people, yada, yada, yada. And a lot of people don't follow Descartes anywhere near that far.
What's the difference between that proof and Anselm's proof?
Oh, well, this is a causal proof. Well, Anselm does, you know, different proofs in the, the Monologion and the Postlogion that he has. In the Monologion, he has what we usually call an ontological proof, that the being than which no greater can be conceived. And then the question is that being? Is that being? Well, if it's not, then you can conceive of a new being, that same being plus being. But your postulate was that what you were thinking before was the being than which no greater being has been conceived, and you've just conceived a greater being, so it wasn't what you thought, and therefore, by principles of indirect proof, has assumed the opposite of what you're trying to prove, show it arrives at a contradiction. You can argue that what you originally wanted to claim is true. So therefore, there is a being greater than which none can be conceived, and it must be, therefore, God.
That's not what happens in the third meditation. It's not really what he's describing in his first go-through. In the fifth meditation, it is sort of an ontological proof, but it's also a meditative proof. The thing is, Descartes, it's a very short proof in Ansel. Basically, it's, you know, two paragraphs. And some of that is the rhetoric about what the fool thinks in his heart, who isn't willing to acknowledge God. And this is just a way to get the fool to see that, how foolish he is. Whereas Descartes, there's no particular moment where you can say that he's proved God ontologically. He does argue, he argues that God is special. You can't think a mountain without a valley. Why? Because a mountain rises out of a valley. No valley, no lower land out of which to come from, no mountain. Okay? Just as a triangle has to have three angles summing 180 degrees is included in the notion of triangle. He says, but none of those imply the existence of the idea in reality. But God is different in that respect. That is, reality is involved in the very concept of God. But if he argues that, and then he reconsiders it because it doesn't sound plausible, and then he reinforces it, and then he goes back and doubts it again, and then he reinforces it again, doubts it again, and then finally... So what he really is using, even when he seems to be making arguments, he's also doing what is characteristic of meditation. That is, you circle around a problem, a circle around an object. You think about it from as many perspectives as you can. And only when you sort of run out of perspectives do you say you've done as much as you can to show it to be the case. But that's not his fundamental proof either. The fifth meditation is a reminder. It's a quick proof of God's existence. Why do you need a quick proof? Just in case you have some doubts about what you're understanding, what and whether you're understanding. And you say, how do I know that these things are true? And you have to remind yourself that God does exist, that God is good because he's good. He does not make us fundamentally creatures subject to deception. That is, there are some use of our powers which is guaranteed to be a good and truthful use of them. And if you remember that you once clearly and distinctly saw something to be true, that you can count on it because of this structure of the nature of truth and the nature of God's being and his veridicality. And he allows us to deceive ourselves, but he's given us some powers that if well used will not deceive us. We can't know everything through them, but we can know enough not to be fundamentally misled. One thing I do, he does, you notice how he is rather critical. He doesn't have a high opinion of poetry. He associates it with rhetoric. It sounds nice. It's glorious in some ways. It's attractive. It's beautiful. This does not seem to be the Descartes of the sweetness, the joy and the sweetness of life, quite yet, or the one who writes the comedy for Queen Christina. Maybe he had a crisis in his 50s, early 50s, and decided to look at the world anew. There is a point where some people read what he says about theology and say, oh, it doesn't sound orthodox to me. I think it's perfectly orthodox. one thing he says is that people have convinced me that we cannot know by reason the truths of revealed faith. Well, duh, that's a basic tenet of the difference between a revelation and natural theology. And he says he doesn't really think his capacities rise, therefore, to the level of penetrating them. But what we are capable of knowing, he thinks that we have all the reason that we need. And some people take that as a lack of religious fervor. I think it's actually more the philosopher's inclination to say, if it's revealed, it's revealed. And I'm not going to try to make it something that I can arrive at by reason. Although my proof of the existence of God will show that he is infinite, that he is a creator, something that Aristotle and Aquinas and Ansel were not willing to say. He's positively infinite. And he is the creator and sustainer of my being. So, but that's a metaphysical position as far as he's concerned. That God is Trinitarian and particulars of creation and of life are not things we can know. But that, once God created the world, he's created it in a way. If he did not create it in a way that is knowable to us, we would be fundamentally misled. Knowable in some basic sense. It would fundamentally mislead us. And so that, so he does frequently appeal to his metaphysics to provide a foundation for his physical understanding of the world. Say, if God did not make it understandable at some level, we would be mysteries unto ourselves and constantly subject to illusion. Oh, I do want to say this. It is an important point to make. It's not credible, and maybe this is where I should stop. It's not credible. I guess I put the question this way. Was it really possible to be an Aristotelian in the 17th century? And I said the answer is no. You couldn't be anymore. What science had discovered in the course of the second half of the 16th century and the early part of the 17th century, lots of things that Aristotle thought about physics were wrong. Why should that be important? Well, Aristotle, for example, thought that the heavens were substantially different than the earth, than the terrestrial. But that turns out not to be true. Even more important is this. Aristotle and Aristotelians, and that includes Thomas, they predicate the operation of our power of knowing on our senses. Whatever is in intellect was originally in sense. That's a direct quote from Aristotle, and almost every Aristotelian medieval thinker, and even some non-Aristotelians quote it over and over again. And certainly Thomas is as faithful to that principle as any. The question is, once you know what the 16th century knew about the physiology of perception, and they knew about the physiology of perception, at least it satisfies our standards in this sense. It was no longer credible. The Aristotelian theory of what was involved in sensation was no longer credible. And if it was no longer credible, if no longer could we say that the sensible in act is the sense in act, the thing in the object that can be sensed is an activity in the object that is identical without the matter and of the activity of the sense organ. And you can no longer say that in the 17th century. Even with Vesalius, and that means we're talking about the 1540s, you can no longer say that. You cannot credibly be an Aristotelian. The epistemology of Aristotle and Thomas fails. If you want to be an Aristotelian, you have work to do. You won't be a really modern Aristotelian unless you do the work of dealing with modern science and not dismissing it, not waving it away. That's wishful thinking. And I don't mean it's just science is sociologically effective. Aristotle is wrong. There may be ways to preserve fundamental Aristotelian principles. Very few neo-scholastics and Thomists have bothered. It's hard. It's hard enough work just recovering texts and interpreting them, Latin texts, much less trying to make modern science compatible with it. But some thinkers have tried it. One person to read. A person who did enormously subtle and sophisticated work, and he needs to have lots more followers. Fritz, forgive me, Fritz had great respect for Bernard Lonergan, L-O-N-E-R-G-A-N. He has a magnificent work called Insight. It is an attempt to bring the principles of Aristotle, the fundamental metaphysical principles of Aristotle and Thomas, up to date and to make them consistent with modern science. And to correct Thomas and Aristotle by understanding the principles of things like statistical reasoning, and also the new understanding that being is not being determined from quantum physics. Not every quality is determined in advance. No one has done a more critical and exceptional job. But the problem with why did I say forgive me, Fritz? Fritz Wilhelmsen, who was a, you can't call Fritz anything. He was an existential Thomist. But some people call him Hume of Thomism, or an existential Thomist. By the way, Gilson was an existential Thomist.
Fritz did not in general like the so-called transcendental Thomists, the Thomists who were trying to reconcile Thomas with, forgive me for saying it, Immanuel Kant. Some people think that's a monstrosity, but that's what Lonergan is doing, saying basically we can't ignore modern science and we can't ignore the metaphysical, at least the metaphysical challenges here. We have to bring that up to date. The interesting thing is that Fritz Wilhelmster, one time I told him, you know, Fritz, I teach recent philosophy here as much as anyone, and I really want to include a great modern, that is between 1800 and 2000 or 1990s, a great modern Catholic philosopher. He says, there aren't any. He says, people like Mari Tanishil saw, they just don't rise to the level. And I said, how about Lonergan? There's a possibility. But see, that was a wonderful thing about Fritz Wilhelmsen. He was a wild man in some ways. He was a Humean existential Thomist. He was also a very generous man, intellectually speaking. And so when he read good philosophy, he admired it even if he disagreed with it. And maybe that's the spirit you should take into all your future education. The great philosophers, you can always learn from the great philosophers. What you want to aspire to is achieving that level where someday, if they could be brought back to life, you could say some things to them that they would learn from. But you have to work for that. Education is always aspirational. It's certainly not a commodity. You don't pay your tuition and get your stuff. It's the funniest thing in the world. You pay us to make you work. Or what it's worth. It was self-indulgent. Maybe an entire time.
No.